You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Some get strong, some get strange. Sooner or later, it all gets real. Walk on, walk on, walk on, walk on.
Maybe you see our way of living is in big trouble. The economy is starting to self-destruct, and maybe the whole world ecosystem with it. You don't want to be part of that, but what can you do? Maybe you should walk out and walk on. That's the title of a book and a movement, co-authored by Margaret Wheatley and Deborah Fries. I've got Deborah on the line now. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be here.
Well, Deborah, a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed permaculture co-founder David Holmgren. He suggests large numbers of people should leave a deadly economy to create the world that they do want. Isn't that just what you did in 2001? Tell us about that.
So I was actually part of the dot-com world. I had been an internet entrepreneur and from 98 to 2001, which was the peak of that experience. And I got extremely disillusioned toward the end, not just the way the bubble burst, but mostly about the way people behaved inside of the system. And I worked with several people who I thought were behaving in greedy ways, very short-term focused. And my first reaction was, these are bad people. And I had, fortunately, some wonderful mentors who sat with me in that thought. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized they weren't bad people. They were playing a flawed game, that the way that we had designed the system of business or really the game of business was generating behavior in the system that made people look bad and made them look like their motivations were greedy. And so that actually introduced me to systems thinking, which somewhere along the way I never got introduced to in my conventional education, which led me to Peter Block and led me to Meg Wheatley, and that was about questioning what are the conditions and the designs of the systems that we're living in that generate outcomes and behaviors that we don't want.
So before a person gets to walk on, though, they do have to walk out, as you did. What does that mean for people in the real world?
Well, in my case, it did mean walking out of my job and walking out of a whole field, walking out of business. It can mean that. More often, it means walking out of a set of beliefs that you don't know that you're holding. They've been inherited by the culture that we're in, and a set of beliefs like maximize efficiency at all costs or maximize profit or consume as much as you can. These are sets of beliefs that are in our dominant culture that most of us didn't actually consciously choose. We inherited them. And when they're tied into a system or an institution, then they're embedded in us as well. And so walking out is actually distinguishing the belief, consume as much as you can, maximize profit, and saying, I actually don't want to live in a world where that becomes my belief. So I can actually walk out of the belief and experiment with that without necessarily having to walk out of the institution, though I may find myself at some point in conflict with the institution.
So does this ability to walk out, is it limited to educated and relatively well-off people in developed countries?
No. In fact, the name of the movement came from India, and the story is that there were a number of young people in Udaipur, India. This is a story that came from my friend Manish Jain that we wrote about in the book. Manish was living in Udaipur, and he noticed there were many high school dropouts in his community, and he started to talk to them about their lives. And, you know, the story was that they had dropped out of high school because they'd failed at school. And the more he looked at their lives, he found that what they were doing is they were apprenticing with people, different like craftspeople in the community. They were talking with elders. They were sitting with each other and exploring ideas and creating true learning for themselves. And he said, you know, you're not dropouts. That's what the system says. You're walkouts. You didn't fail the system. The system failed you. Congratulations on walking out of it and creating learning in the world and in your community because the school failed to create learning for you in these kinds of factory schools that are very testing-oriented that are trying to produce productive workers. So it can happen anywhere, in any culture, in any level of poverty or richness.
We're not used to the idea of emergence that you talk about in our Western-style civilization. Just tell us briefly, what is it and how does it apply to these kind of life choices?
So the conventional way that we think about change actually has a real industrial mindset or a machine mind, that we look at change like we can plan for it, that it is controllable, causal, predictable, and linear. So we do our five-year plans, right? We're here we are today. We look out 5 years. We say this is where we want to be, and we create a roadmap to get there. And inevitably, we never arrive at the destination we set because life is complex, emergent, and unpredictable. That means that we don't actually behave like machines. It isn't a planable, predictable phenomenon of change. Change happens in life through emergence, which is the idea that local action gets connected, and as those connections get stronger and stronger, suddenly and surprisingly, a new system of higher order emerges. And an easy way to think about this is like a beehive or ant. So you have very small local action happening at the level of the individual ant or bee, but the order that exists at the hive is of a whole different nature than the intelligence in the individual. And so emergence is the phenomenon of small local actions connecting to reveal higher order.
That's fascinating. And another stimulating idea I found in your writing was the idea that a system can reach a stage of impotence, as you call it. Are we there now?
So this might be debatable, but some people, you know, would say whether nobody planned for our education system, our healthcare system, our government system, Wall Street, to be as futile in many ways as they are today. That is an emergent phenomenon. And so as systems mature, self-organization gets replaced by over-organization, and compliance becomes more important than creativity. So we start to reverse the means and the ends, and we struggle to uphold the system rather than having the system support us. And when systems reach this stage of impotence, then we as individuals and communities have a choice. We can either keep trying to change a complex emergent phenomenon, which is incredibly difficult, or we can abandon it. And that's what walking out is about. The suggestion that these complex systems are very, very difficult to repair. And instead of repairing them, we can turn our back on them and work on creating something new.
Yes, Joseph Tainter talked about complex systems. And, you know, it almost reminds me of the times of the Romans when that empire was falling apart. And maybe the Christian movement came along as a kind of hospice for it. And you talk about hospice. How does that apply to the troubled world around us?
So we talk about, you know, when we want to look at giving rise to new systems, the experimentation in the new, the pioneering role, is very challenging. There's lots of failure. We don't know what we're doing. And so there's still dominant systems that we need to continue. And we call it hospice work, when people are working inside of a dying system. So let's say something like the oil economy or industrial food, right? So you have a failing system, and yet the new one, renewable energy or local organic food, those systems are not ready to sustain all of us in the world. We actually need people to stay inside the dominant system as it's dying, in the role of hospice workers, giving comfort and support and decreasing the suffering that the failure of those systems are causing. So the role of the hospice worker is critical. Sometimes people get the idea that the pioneer developing the new is very glamorous. You can have the pioneering ideas, and you can be in that role of shedding limiting beliefs and stay inside of dominant systems in order to provide this compassionate care.
Well, on a personal level, though, Deborah, isn't it going to feel lonely if we are pioneers when we disconnect from the social pathways that we've taken for granted all our lives?
I think it can feel very lonely if we do that in isolation. And the one thing that we've learned the most from all of the different pioneers that we've talked to around the world is pioneering leaders feel isolated and alone. They desperately need each other. The minute they look for each other, they find each other. This process for me has been one of the least lonely journeys I've ever taken, but it requires finding fellow pioneers. And what seems to be remarkable to me is actually how easy it is to find them, whether it's in our local communities or somewhere else because of our issue area. They're all over the place. And it's just about creating the conversation and the invitation to find out who else is thinking like me, who else is raising the kinds of questions that I am. Even inside of my institutional life, is it possible for me to find fellow pioneers who are thinking differently about life and about change?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with our guest, Deborah Fries. We're talking about walking out of dead-end lifestyles. And I have to say, though, that the systems we're trying to change, it has lots of defenses. It has a history of jailing people, of spying people, and trying to crush alternative pioneers. How do we deal with that?
This has been a challenging question for us all along. And there's some sort of conversation about working under the radar versus when we pop up above the radar. And that's actually starting to happen in the world today about some of these pioneering lifestyles around renewable energy and alternative food and things like that, where when we don't know what we're doing, which is the early stage of pioneering, we do work under the radar. We talk among each other. We experiment together. When we get strong enough and connect to enough of others like us, then it's possible to face the dominant system. So we actually can only do that in crowds, in connectivity. And so that's the part where emergence becomes significant, because the notion that these, again, the small local action is easily crushed or co-opted by the dominant system. But small local action that's connecting to other small local action, to other small local action, becomes a resilient system that can withstand attack.
You've talked about this idea of two loops theory of change, and I believe you gave the example of peak oil in one of your talks. How does that work?
The two-loop theory of change is what I've been talking about, with this notion that there's a dominant system, and every system has a life cycle. That's how you think about living systems. And it rises, and it peaks, and it moves into decline. And sometime around the peak, alternatives to the dominant system show up. So the example that we talk about often is in the 1970s, when the United States hit its peak oil, we saw the rise of a lot of alternative energy, solar, geothermal, wind, et cetera. We also saw the kind of shocks in supply and demand during the oil crises that indicated we were at some sort of peak. That's a sign of peak. When the new alternatives showed up, it started to work for a while, right? We had tax incentives. Jimmy Carter put solar panels on the White House roof. The system, the new alternative renewable energy system, is starting to arise, but every system is inclined towards self-preservation. And so Reagan comes into office, the tax incentives go underground, and he takes the solar panels off the White House roof. Because the system, the dominant system of an oil economy, is trying to preserve itself and crush the alternatives. The good news is, when a system is really peaked and really is dying, the alternatives will continue to show up and continue to show up. And here we are several decades later with a truly viable renewable economy emerging in a place like Iceland that is 100% renewable. So this notion is that as the two loops, as the top loop is the rise and peak and decline of a dominant system, and another loop giving birth underneath it, that in the time between the peak of the dying and the emergence of the new, which I think is a time we're living in across many systems today, we see a lot of turbulence alongside an enormous amount of innovation.
Well, maybe we're ready to walk out, but then the obvious question is, what are we supposed to walk on to? Give us some suggestions there.
This suggestion is very, very messy. We talk about walking out and walking on, and in between the two is a stage that we call the trembling. And the trembling is, I've figured out the limiting beliefs that I no longer want to live under, and I don't know yet what I'm ready to walk on to. And I have to hang out in this state of unknowing and uncertainty. And the reason is that if I walk on right away, I'm likely to walk right back in. I'm likely to still hold beliefs from the dominant system that I'm not aware of that direct me, pull me back into an old model. And so hanging out in the trembling is this place of discomfort. It requires a lot of internal space, so some silence, some quiet. It requires community. And the motto that I use for hanging out in that space is something I learned from one of Meg's colleagues, Myron Kellner-Rogers, who said, start anywhere, follow it everywhere. That means I don't have to know where I'm going. I could hang out in the trembling and say, there's something that I want to explore around the role of money. There's something I want to explore about my relationship to waste. And the first thing is right in front of me. I'm going to start to upcycle all my garbage, whatever it might be. I'm going to do one small experiment, and then I'm going to see what that leads to. And then I'm going to see what that leads to. And that's the way out. If we think too big right away, it's frightening. We don't know how to do it. So it's these small actions, this start anywhere, follow it everywhere, to get from the trembling to what I want to walk on to.
Now, for some people, these ideas lead to the idea of intentional communities. Have you visited some of those? Could you talk to us about a couple?
Yeah, I mean, the one I'd like to talk about the most is Kafunda Learning Village in Zimbabwe, and that is also what we wrote about in our book. Kafunda is an amazing place that was started by a woman named Marianne Knuth, who had left Zimbabwe and gotten involved in international networks and had quite a career, and said, I need to go back home, and I need to create community where I've come from in a country who essentially went through a total systems collapse on every level. And in the face of no money system, no school system, no health care, a failed food system, a small group of people gathered together and said, in the face of actual scarcity, what would happen if we declared abundance? What would happen if we were bold enough to say we have what we need? What would we be able to create together? So it was an experiment just like, how can we go live in an intentional community because it feels nice? We don't have a choice. And from that place, Kafunda has created one of the most astonishing places I've ever been in my life that I've learned from more than anywhere about what it means to live in community and to create and be resourceful and be inventive in the face of constraints.
Well, there's a large number of people in North America and in England and in Australia who think that this could happen even to our own societies, where money becomes relatively worthless fairly quickly and we have a supreme economic destructive period. So, you know, and we have the preppers are getting ready for that. How can we plant these seeds of what you're talking about so that they're out there if such a time arrives?
I think that this is where I think it's all about local relationship. So we really have to look at the places that we live in and what our preparedness is for disturbance and shock. So when we live with the intentional relationship to being a resilient community, a community that can respond to disruption, the way that we do that is by being in deep personal relationship with our neighbors, even more so than what are the institutions that are here. It means that I know who lives around me. I'm experimenting with them. We're learning what it takes to grow food. I live in downtown Boston, so we're learning what it takes to grow food together. We're experimenting with alternative economies. We have some way of being in relationship with each other. So, you know, I'm part of a transition town network, which I think is one of the useful tools for it. There are many other tools like that, but we need to figure out how we can restore our relationship as citizens and neighbors and community. It's the only way. Again, it's that same notion of emergence. If we're in relationship with each other, we have the ingenuity and the intelligence and the trust that we need to face disruption.
Well, Deborah Fries, another reason I called you up is about the future of climate change and extreme weather events, which we're already experiencing. It looks like millions, maybe billions of people could find themselves in an environment that's no longer livable. They may have coastal cities that flood over, or maybe persistent long-term drought that kills off agriculture. How do you see the future for walk out, walk on in those kind of scenarios?
I think this is where my experience in Zimbabwe was so powerful for me, because that's what it looks like. Right, that is an example of a very rapid total system failure in a community. And the response was diving in with our hands. This was not about getting outsiders and government agencies and nonprofits to respond. This was a community that was ignored. In fact, one of the things we talk about in Walk Out, Walk On, the theme is, in these communities, no one is coming to help. Now what? And the now what is, how do we grow food together? How do we exchange goods and services? How do we take care of our elders? How do we take care of our children? And it comes back to what sounds like overly simple, but being in relationship side by side and starting now to practice. I mean, I live in a wonderful community that has, you know, everybody I know is growing food in their backyard as much as they can and on their rooftops and using bicycles and figuring out, how do we experiment with this moving past peak oil? How do we experiment with the kind of climate crisis that we're in and learn how to adapt? We need to learn how to adapt and be rapid learners, and that comes back to neighbors practicing together.
And in your blog entry, I found this quote from the poet William Stafford, "It's time for all the heroes to go home." What are you talking about there?
So we have a model of heroic leadership in our country and in the world that imagines that our leaders are going to save the day, right? We expected Obama to come in and save the day. We expect any of our leaders, our CEOs, heads of Wall Street, things like that, that they're going to fix our problems. And obviously, the answer is the opposite. And the reason is no single leader today can possibly know the answers. Our problems are complex, emergent phenomenon. The only way out of that is through collective intelligence. It's the leader, not as hero, who we're supposed to follow, but the leader as host, who convenes many people to bring forward their gift and their perspective. So we take the intelligence on the margins instead of the center, and we bring all of our gifts to solving the problem collectively. And so that's the shift from hero to host, is saying, and we're colluding in it. We collude in our dependence on our leaders. It's time for our leaders to invite all of us to show up, and it's time for us to be willing to take responsibility for solving our problems.
Boy, I can hear a lot of that in stressed communities all over, where the mayor calls the meeting and we're supposed to sit and listen to experts and then all go away without saying anything. It just doesn't work out that way. Look, we're not going to get too far talking about walk out and walk on without talking about Margaret Wheatley. Tell us about her, please.
I met Meg back in 2002, and it completely changed my life. She had written a book in 1991 called Leadership in the New Science, and it was a breakthrough in thinking about how living systems is the way that we can look at the world instead of this industrial or machine mindset that I talked about earlier. The notion that the way we've modeled human organization is on machine, like people do what they're told and should be controlled. And living systems says humans are fundamentally creative and inventive. Why don't we design organizational life that works with the dynamics of emergence and self-organization? That's how life changes. That's how human organization should be designed. And from that, she created the Berkana Institute, where I succeeded her, which was about looking at this question of, if we look at life and change through this living systems lens, how then will we design our organizations? What do we expect of leaders? And how do we want to behave in community? And so conversation becomes the center of it, dependence on collective intelligence rather than the expert or the heroic leader, and this notion that we can't predict where we're headed, but through relationship we can create the conditions for the systems that we wish to arise.
So I have to ask, though, is this movement different from the counterculture of the late 1960s when Timothy Leary advised us to turn on, tune in, and drop out?
I certainly hope so. I don't think it has anything to do with dropping out. It's the opposite. It's full engagement. It's stepping forward with my intelligence, with my gifts, and with my perspective in every environment I walk into. That means both at home with my neighbors, it means in the workplace, and it means in civic engagement. What it's shifting from, we're not trying to fight the power that be, and if we don't want to fight, then we drop out. It's actually using what I think of, instead of fighting and dropping out, I think of it as using seduction and charm, saying there is another way to work with change, and there's another world that we wish to give birth to, and it is so engaging and it is so exciting. So an example of that is we work with the dynamic of play rather than power. So a lot of the change approach in the 60s around change was fighting power, working against power, demonstrating against power. And the way that we look at it is playing to change the world, because it's more fun, it's more compelling, and by the way, it's also incredibly subversive. So there's other ways to be fully engaged without the struggle and without the suffering and without dropping out.
Can you give us some websites with more information, or tell us what resources you offer, and talk about the book a little too, please?
Sure. So Walk Out, Walk On is the book chronicles seven different communities around the world that we believe have walked out and walked on to build healthy and resilient communities, and what the patterns and practices of those communities are and how they apply to us. And then we've got walkoutwalkon.net, and on that website we list many, many different resources, videos, books, articles in each of the different areas that we've looked at, both in terms of sector, like education and food, as well as place, the seven different places that we visit. So that lists quite a few resources. And there's also the Berkana Institute, which is berkana.org.
And you have your own website, don't you?
And I've got three other websites. Yes, I've got deborahfreeze.com, and then the two initiatives that I'm involved with today. One is called the Old Oak Dojo, which is a learning center that I've built, modeled on the communities I visited, that is right here in Jamaica Plain in Boston, and the Boston Impact Initiative, which is bostonimpact.com, which is about restructuring the way we use money and investment to support local economies.
I found this really inspiring. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about getting out and helping a dying system head towards a life that you can really believe in. Our guest is Deborah Fries, co-author of the book Walk Out, Walk On. Thank you for all your work, Deborah. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.